Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
This episode is brought to you by Jack Henry Digital, the pioneer and creator of personal digital banking that helps community financial institutions translate their trust and live, local, personal service meaningfully into digital channels for the first time. This is a very exciting show. It's been in the works for close to a year. We started as a single show, Breaking Banks, with a single host, Brett King, in a pretty tight focus, the disruption in banking caused by financial technology. The show quickly expanded the range of topics it explored based on listener demand. The regular guests also expanded, JP and I among them, until we became co-hosts. The show also began to proliferate. We now have Breaking Banks Europe, Finovate, and Tech on Reg. Today, we're pleased to give you a sneak peek of the newest show on the Provote Network, Emerge Everywhere. Emerge is the flagship in-person event of the Financial Health Network to talk about financial inclusion. Emerge Everywhere is a bi-weekly podcast starting in September that makes this incredible event more inclusive and more accessible by bringing it straight to your phone or however you listen to your podcasts. Today, we have Jennifer Tesher, Financial Health Network founder and CEO, talking about the podcast and sharing some highlights from her first interview. None other than Dan Schulman, CEO of PayPal, talking about inclusivity, equity, and breaking down silos. Starting in September, you'll get these bi-weekly episodes of Emerge Everywhere, exploring these topics with silo busters, the cutting-edge Financial Health Network research, and inspiring stories. Don't wait. Go to provoke.fm and click on Emerge at the top to subscribe so you'll automatically be notified when the show airs. These are critical conversations, and you, our listeners, have told us again and again that the episodes on inclusivity and access are favorites. We couldn't be more pleased to have a dedicated podcast done by none other than the leader in the space. Now, here's Jen.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the world's number one radio show and podcast focused on fintech. We go to 180 countries, and joining me again in the hosting seat this week is my co-host, Jason Henricks. Jason, thanks for joining us.
You didn't really give me a choice, Brett, but
no,
but that is what it is.
But you love it anyway, so.
Yeah, I do.
This week, we're introducing to you guys a well-known regular on the show. She's been on the show for many years now. But in addition to that, we're introducing a new member into the Provoke family, a new podcast that you guys are going to love. And I'm talking about the Emerge podcast. And so if you know the Emerge brand at all, it sits on top of the US's largest nonprofit focused on financial inclusion, which is the Financial Health Network, and it's run by Jen Tesher, the CEO of Financial Health Network. So she's joining us to tell us a bit more about the Emerge event that's recently happened and what gave birth to the new podcast that we're introducing to you guys today. And there's some great content you're going to hear, particularly from the first interviewee on the podcast for Emerge, which is Dan Schulman, the CEO of PayPal. So some really great content for you guys. Let's first introduce Jen and get her on the show. Jen, welcome back onto Breaking Banks.
Thanks, guys. You know, they say you don't get to pick your family, but I kind of feel like I've gotten to pick my family. So glad to have my new podcast on your station.
Well, absolutely. We didn't really give you much of a choice. We've only been having this conversation for at least 3 years. And when I was going through the archives, the first episode I found was you and Brett talking back in 2015 was the first show that we actually did on inclusion. So
wow.
It's been an awfully long courtship to get you to agree to be a host.
Wow. Well, that's thanks great. For your faith in me. I'm really excited about taking to the airwaves, shall we say.
So first of all, let's get a little bit more detail on the Financial Health Network and its mission overall, Jen. How would you articulate that for those that may not be familiar, particularly offshore?
Well, I probably should make you do that, Brett, since you are a member of the board, but I won't. We'll put you on the spot. The Financial Health Network is really a resource to the business community to help them understand the importance of measuring the financial health of their customers, their employees, communities, and then helping them to design the products, the practices, the strategies that they need to help improve financial health for all.
One of the things I'd like to tease out, so when I first met you in 2008, we were talking about the un- and underbanked, and the organization was known as the Center for Financial Service Innovation. And you've recently made this shift, and I still have to keep reminding myself not to call it CFSI. But I think the motivation behind the shift is a really important one as you've looked more holistically at health and wealth and what that means.
Yeah, so it's been a little over 16 years since I founded what was then CFSI. And we've really been on a journey as the world continues to evolve. A lot has happened in the last 16 years. We started the organization before the iPhone existed. Need I say more? So when we first were launched, it was exactly as you said, to think about inclusion for the un- and underbanked. And then 2008 happened, plus the iPhone was invented. And so all of a sudden, it became clear that access might not be like the most important thing anymore. It might be that technology had made huge strides towards inclusion, in part with the iPhone and prepaid cards, at the same time that the financial crisis and recession was both calling into question whether those bank products were so good for you after all, and demonstrating that this was not just an issue of people who didn't have a bank account or low-income people. This was the majority of Americans who are struggling financially. And so at that point, we really shifted to a focus on what we called then financial health. And it was this idea that people have hopes and dreams for their broader financial lives about being able to be resilient and to thrive, and that we were going to need more than bank accounts and more than access to get them there. And so we've been working on that mission now for quite some time. And we realized that we wanted a name that was actually going to represent what we do every day. And so a year ago, a little over a year ago, at last year's Emerge in 2019, we launched our new brand, the Financial Health Network. And I think the other reason we chose this name and chose to rebrand is because in our newest incarnation, if you will, it's become clear to us that to move the needle on financial health, it's not just about financial services either. It requires a whole other set of actors across the economy to participate. It requires employers who are thinking about the financial health of their workforce, requires healthcare providers who are thinking about the financial health of their patients, requires higher ed thinking about the financial health of their students, and so on. And so we're really trying to grow a financial health ecosystem, if you will, that includes a wide array of different actors, all focusing on this broader mission of financial health.
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, in the midst of coronavirus, the economic effects of coronavirus will probably last much longer than the effects of the pandemic. And so it's never been more important than being able to help people recover from those economic effects. And that comes back to the core mission of financial health. But there's also some other very interesting correlations, is that when you've got people that are broadly financially healthy, the economy also is broadly financially healthy. So when you have a strong, robust middle class, like the American economy after the Second World War, where the GI Bill and all of those things, the investment in infrastructure, all that created this massive explosion in investment in the middle class and growth in the middle class, that led to a housing boom, consumption, you know, the electronics boom, all of those things came out of that and was really a core part of the American dream. So when you get people financially healthy, it helps the economy. And clearly, you know, we need that sort of intelligence coming out of COVID. The other thing I think, Jen, that's interesting is that as an organization, and, you know, speaking as a board member, we've also discovered that financial health and physical health are very tightly correlated. There's a lot of similarities in respect to that. So did you want to talk a little bit about, you know, like overall health and where finances and overall health fits in together?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. We don't tend to think about financial services and healthcare having much in common as industries, but they actually have a lot in common. They both represent about 20% of GDP in this country. Not sure that's necessarily a good thing, but it's the fact. They both claim to be really focused on the customer or the patient, but they actually tend to get caught up in a lot of bureaucracy and red tape that makes them focused more on their own mousetrap than on the people they're serving. They also have this interesting issue of having systemic issues around reaching and serving the most vulnerable. And at the same time, there being an element of behavior, right? The way we consume financial services and manage our financial lives, the way that we consume healthcare and manage our physical and mental health are both driven both by a set of structural and systemic structures and the choices and decisions that we make every day. And it's really the combination of those two things that I think leads both to financial health and to physical health. And I think in a way, COVID is the perfect example of the deep intersections. First, it's how healthcare is delivered in this country. For working people, it's largely through your employer. So all of a sudden, if you lose your job, there goes your health insurance. But also, it's often the stress that you have over your finances that's causing you to be sick in the first place. We did a focus group once, and the guy said, "You want to lower my blood pressure? Help me pay my bills on time." That's really what's causing my concern. And then there's the issue of catastrophic health issues, or frankly, not even catastrophic. You could go in for something that seems minor, come out with a huge bill. Even if you have good insurance, not going to cover it. You end up with a financial problem that you didn't think you were going to have. So I could go on, but there are such deep interconnections between those two things. We're really excited about the work we're doing to explore them.
You know, we also need to look at the educational component, right? Because education tends to impact, you know, where you go financially, but it also impacts your health. And when you think about that intersection, the American Student Assistance Organization, another nonprofit focused on college affordability, showed that over 40% of respondents said that worrying about student loans has physically impacted their health, not just the mental health, which was closer to 80% said worrying about, you know, student loans was impacting their mental well-being, let alone their physical health, right? And all of these begin to intersect together.
And can you imagine going into debt to go to college only to drop out because you have money issues? So you have debt and no degree. It's like the worst possible outcome, which is where we've really focused our work as it relates to higher ed and student health. The numbers on the number of college students who are food insecure, housing insecure, I mean, who are homeless, living in their cars or on other people's couches, it's really staggering. We're so focused on the paying for college that we don't think about the paying for life. And then, you know, as Brett was talking about earlier, we have to bring employers into this mix. Brett was talking about post-World War II, which was, you know, unfortunately beginning to think it might have been a momentary blip in this country's history. We'll see. Back then, CEOs really thought it was their responsibility to help put all the men who had been fighting in World War II back to work, that was their job, and that they were really responsible for everything related to those folks' needs. If you weren't working, that was the government's responsibility to create that safety net. And so all of the benefits that we have today, including healthcare through the employer, all grew out of that time period. But as we all know, in the last several decades, that social contract has really frayed. And all it took was looking at the number of working people who did not have paid leave in this time of the pandemic to really see just how critical the employer has been to people's resilience and stability. And that as employers have dialed back what they're willing to do for employees, we haven't yet had a national reckoning of, well, who's going to provide that? Is that going to be the employer? Is that going to be the government? But increasingly, employers are really waking up to this issue and recognize that if they want to reduce their own healthcare costs, for instance, they've got to think about the financial health issues as well. So we're seeing a tremendous amount of engagement from employers.
Yeah, it's all interconnected. You know, when we look at the populist movement, we look at protests that, I don't know whether you guys are aware of this, but a stat I did give Jen at the Emerge conference is that protests since 2000 have increased 700% globally, right? Mm-hmm. And this is already an increased trend from the 1980s. So you can see this social unrest that's been driven. So when you look at the populist movement, and when you look at protests that are driven, what is the underlying thing that they have in common? It's economic uncertainty, right? It's people fearful about the future, that they're going to be able to afford to pay, you know, for their food, their rent, for their kids and things like that. So this economic uncertainty, when you look at healthcare and it's linked to financial well-being, you know, 2/3 of bankruptcies in the United States are attributed to medical costs, you know, so, and you got this student debt, looming student debt, the largest class of debt that we carry as a country now beyond mortgages is student debt. So these are key elements where, you know, inequality is become a real problem. In the US, 125th in the world in terms of ranking for income equality. And this is obviously impacting low to middle income households, but dramatically worse for someone who's African American in this country from a financial equality perspective than if you're born in, you know, predominantly white neighborhoods, as an example. And so when we look at the racial inequality, the protests now, again, that comes back to financial distress. It comes back to income inequality and so forth. All of that actually means you look at the US economy compared with China right now. The US economy is shrinking in terms of its global power. The Chinese economy is growing. What are the differences there? China has decreasing inequality. They have a growing middle class. They have growing wealth distribution to more of the economy than they've had in the past. And exactly the opposite is occurring in the United States. So that's why you see the erosion of the American dream to many extents. But let's sort of bring in some of the content that you guys have been working on, Jen, in respect to this. And maybe talk to us about, you know, the first guest that you have on the podcast. Well, maybe let's start with, why did you decide to go down the podcast path?
Well, aside from you and Jason twisting my arm, a few reasons. You know, I'm a former journalist. It's been a very long time now, but that's what I thought I'd be doing for a living. This is about the last thing on earth I thought I'd be doing. There's something about asking questions that's always been part of my personality. I'm a naturally curious person. And I think that in a way, asking questions suggests, well, maybe there's a different way of doing things. And so I think it's a really powerful medium for raising up important issues and ultimately helping to drive change, to change the discussion. And that's a big part of what we're doing at the Financial Health Network. I think the other reason is, you know, we've all been cooped up in our homes. We had to cancel our Emerge in-person event, and we retooled it as a virtual event, which was successful, but different. It's very different. I feel like there's a tremendous amount of appetite right now for real conversation and real dialogue, particularly because we can't be together in person. And so I felt like this was a really good time to launch it because, you know, we did our Emerge event once a year in one place, but things are moving to so quickly. We can't wait around. You know, we've got to keep the conversation real and live. And so that's why I felt like it was a good time to launch Emerge Everywhere.
One of the benefits of Emerge Everywhere is, you know, Emerge is a fantastic platform, but it is not all that accessible. And by doing Correct. It digitally and by podcast, you know, we still have a problem with the digital divide in this country and globally, but you've certainly made it more accessible for people who wouldn't be able to hear from, say, your first guest, Dan Schulman, CEO and president of PayPal. And to hear his stories, you know, it was just amazing. And I've heard him speak before, but never in that sort of intimate way of the two of you having this fireside and the things he shared, you know, were just phenomenal. And to now know that a lot of people are going to be able to hear that kind of story. Was there anything that he said that surprised you or that immediately jumped down and said, wow, I never would have thought that?
You know, I've had the privilege and the pleasure of knowing Dan and interviewing him and talking to him as a colleague many times, but I always learn something new from him. The story that was new to me was the one he told about his father, that his father was a factory foreman, I think he said, and in one of the factories in the Deep South, a black employee had been unceremoniously fired and wrongfully fired. And his father flew down there to make it right. And I tend to believe that while leadership can be taught, and you can improve as a leader all the time, that people who care about the issues we're talking about today generally have had some personal experience in their lives. Someone they know, a family member, the way they were raised, that brings them to the work in a genuine way. And, you know, Dan confirms that for me every time we talk.
Well, without further ado, why don't we play that clip of Dan describing why they had some concern that he might actually get an FBI file on himself because his mom was taking him to protests in a baby carriage and the profound impact that had on him.
My dad was worried that I would be the youngest person to ever have an FBI file because my mom was pushing me in my baby carriage at civil rights marches. And my dad, you know, who worked his way up out of college on the GI Bill to become the manager of a chemical plant down in Mississippi. And one day, one of the black workers was fired by the white foreman there, who did not report to my dad for drinking at the wrong water fountain. And my dad told my mom that he would need to travel down to Mississippi right in the middle of the 1960s, pretty even dangerous time. My mom was quite fearful for what would happen to my dad. And my dad went down there and reversed that decision. And I still remember that vividly to this day. And so that idea of thinking about underserved communities, what we can do for them, how we can work together, where you can make a difference has been a motivating force for me for as long as I can remember.
Jennifer, I think you had a great lead in to that clip about, you know, that personal impact. And I think this is one of the reasons hearing these stories is so important is there's a good set of this country who haven't had those experiences. And I have to be the first to raise my hand. I grew up in such a small town in southern Wisconsin. I still remember when they were talking about putting a stoplight in. Like literally it was dividing the town, the fact that a stoplight was going to go in. That's how small this town was. But it also meant, I still remember the first time I met someone who was not white. And so I didn't have the benefit of some of those Dan experiences of my parents talking about social activism because it just wasn't that kind of relevance. And I think that some of the stories that you're bringing to people is so important from an educational component. Are there other stories that you expect to tell in terms of themes for the Emerge Everywhere?
Yeah, I think what motivates people to action and to be thinking about the need to improve financial health and why it's important, that's certainly one. But I think the core theme for this podcast is really about what does it take to build an integrated financial health system. During my speech at our conference, our virtual conference, I talked a lot about this idea of silos, that the pandemic for me really demonstrated just how siloed we are. Despite the fact that we're more interconnected than ever, certainly from a technology perspective. And that despite all that interconnection, not only are we all alone, but we tend to categorize everything into these little silos when what we're seeing in the world tells us that our physical health, our financial health, our education, the people we interact with every day, like that we need a much more interconnected, integrated set of solutions. And it's an idea that I'm really interested to explore because when you're the CEO of a major company or organization, you tend to be laser focused on that company and what you need to do to perform to meet expectations. And hopefully you're also really focused on your customers and your employees, although it's not always a given. But the question is, if you're really focusing on your employees and your customers and the communities in which you operate, how can you stay so focused? How do you start to see across, to see the other needs that the people you serve have and how you might be part of the solution to bring them? The example I'll give is in the speech I gave, I talked about American Family Insurance. They bought another non-standard insurance company, high-priced auto insurance for subprime drivers. This wasn't a customer base they knew very well. And what they learned very quickly was that their customers had trouble paying on time, but always wanted to catch up. They wanted the insurance. And so they did a bunch of focus groups to understand, what could we be doing to help you? Well, you could help me make some more money. And so they started an entirely new company, a temp agency for shift work. Who'd ever think of an insurance company owning a temp agency, starting one from scratch, let alone, and now owning a temp agency, just so they can help their customers generate more money, which enables them to then pay on time. That's an example of integrated financial health thinking. And we need to get more companies, more CEOs, more leaders thinking this way. And so those are the kind of conversations I'm hoping to spark on the podcast.
One of those things that you had in that conversation with Dan, and one that really struck home for me, was this one around income equality and how he was thinking about it when he had first come to PayPal. And they were looking across, you know, gender, they were looking across race, they were looking across all sorts of different metrics. And he was taking that holistic, you know, you'd mentioned this whole idea of you get so myopic around the business. And yet he'd realize the main asset within the business, which is their employee as a stakeholder, wasn't about bottom line, but they were making a big mistake there. And I'll let you, you know, share a little bit about what came out of that interview.
You know, when Dan first got to PayPal 5+ years ago, it was really about turning that company from thinking of itself as a technology company to being focused on customers, the people actually using the service to move the money. And then when he got into his tenure further, he started to pay more attention to their employees. And they thought they were doing pretty well by them. They pay well, they have good benefits, but they went and decided to measure how are our employees actually doing. And they used a really interesting metric, net disposable income. How much money have you got left over after you pay all your bills? What he found was really shocking to him, that the net disposable income, I think, typically at the company was something like 6%. And so they actually set a target. They want all their employees to have 20% net disposable income. And they've taken a whole bunch of steps to try to do that.
So why don't we go to a clip from Dan Schulman talking about income inequality and, you know, his thoughts on that systemically.
How much income does an employee have after they pay taxes and essential living expenses? And you need to do that location by location across the world. It's very different. And what we found in the U.S. is that our employees had between something like 4 to 6% NDI. So no wonder they were struggling to make ends meet. That's like anything outside of essential living, they had almost nothing saved. And we decided that we were going to set a target of 20% NDI as a minimum for any employee of PayPal. And so we lowered the cost of healthcare benefits by 60%. So people wouldn't have to trade off getting healthcare or having food on the table. We gave every single employee in PayPal equity in the company so they could share in our success. We raised salaries where we needed to, and we surrounded all of it in a financial education program. Because as you know, if you've never had equity before, you've never had the wherewithal to save before, understanding that is so crucial. And the results have been amazing as we've gotten closer and closer to 20%. In many parts of the world, we're over 20%. Hopefully by the end of this year, we'll be over 20% for all employees. That has made a radical difference in their lives. And to me, moving from being a good company, which I think PayPal is today, but we're not a great company. But one of the foundational elements of moving from good to great is having a passionate workforce that believes in your mission, embraces your values, but also has at its foundation that they're financially secure and financially healthy, because that unleashes that passion. So yeah, I've spent a lot of time on thinking about employees as my number one constituency to serve.
And in fact, Jen, it's worse than 6%. He called it out right there. It's in, you know, the even lower single digits, which the thing that really stuck out in that clip for me is the boldness when he was asked about, you know, are we going to phase this in over, you know, a couple of years. And he was like, no, like something is wrong. We need to go fix it. We need to go fix it now.
Right. In fact, I think he said, well, let's go do that next week. And in fact, I happen to know that when he went out and made the announcement, when he happened to be somewhere with reporters sticking microphones in his face, and I think he scooped his staff a little bit. I don't think they were quite ready for the announcement. So he is
a
man
of... way to get the organization moving.
That's right.
He is to the press.
He is a man of action.
Now it's time for a quick break. When we come back, more of Brett, Jennifer, and I talking about inclusion, equity, and breaking down silos.
You know, now that so many of us are staying home and working more from home, a lot of businesses have found themselves suddenly in the e-commerce business, and they're finding it's tough to keep up with the new standards of what we're calling delivery culture. But now you can with ShipStation. No matter where you're selling, if it's through your own website or through something like Amazon or Etsy, ShipStation brings all of your orders into one simple interface. You can even manage it all right on your phone. ShipStation works with all the major carriers, including FedEx, UPS, the U.S. Postal Service, even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customers. They even offer big discounts on shipping costs, so now your business can access the same discounts that the big players get, and you'll always know you're getting the best deal. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice for online sellers. You'll ship more in less time with the best rates available. And right now, Breaking Banks listeners can try ShipStation free for 60 days when you use offer code FinTech. Make sure your business is ready to meet the demands of delivery culture. Get started at ShipStation.com today. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and just type in FinTech. That's ShipStation.com and then enter the code FinTech. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen.
Supporting contract employees and the gigging economy is more important than ever during the coronavirus crisis. So if you're a business owner, chances are at some point you're going to need some flexibility in your workforce. You're going to need to bring in some people with special skills, a freelancer, maybe a designer, a copywriter, someone involved in coding, setting up a website. You know, we need voiceover actors sometimes for our work at Breaking Banks. So where do you go to find the right experience, have predictable costing, and hire freelancers with proven track records and clear pricing? If you want a solution to this, go to Fiverr.com. Fiverr has the ability to offer meaningful resources to help small businesses transition into the new normal of the post-coronavirus world. They connect businesses with freelancers offering hundreds of digital services. You can work with confidence. You can search by the type of service you're looking for, deadline, price reviews, and more. You know exactly what you're paying for up front, no hourly rates or negotiation, and payments only released once the freelancer has completed the work and you approve it. 24/7 customer service anytime you have an issue. Find your talent today at Fiverr.com and receive 10% off your first order using our code BREAKING. All the digital services you need are in one place at Fiverr.com code BREAKING. Again, that's Fiverr.com code BREAKING.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa. Play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
The Finovate podcast is your home for interesting conversations and insights from Finovate's global conference series. I'm Greg Palmer. Join me as I interview leading innovators, bankers, analysts, venture capitalists, and more to get their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Find us wherever you normally listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm.
And now, here's more
Breaking Banks.
I'm very interested in sort of this systemic view, because if you look at the system that we have right now under, you know, the pressure of coronavirus, you could argue that what is considered the greatest economy in the world based on capitalism, it was just a matter of weeks after coronavirus hit us and we have 40 million people unemployed. We have this massive shift. Now, some of those jobs will come back, and we've seen as states have reopened, there's been a bit of a surge of that, but not all of those jobs will come back. And the problem is, as you rightly pointed out, is that healthcare is subject to you having employment. And all of those elements of the fact that capitalism had zero safety net built into it. You know, we didn't have ventilators required to handle this, the ICU beds. We didn't have a way to get people paid when they lost their job and therefore they lost health insurance. So you could argue that, you know, capitalism failed because it didn't have broader social goals, right? There's not a systemic commitment from the free market, for example, to solve problems like climate change or for pharma companies to produce drugs in excess quantities or hospitals to have empty ICU beds in case there's a pandemic. The market just doesn't incentivize for those sort of things. So when you talk about a systemic approach to this, and we see stimulus payments coming out, but one stimulus payment, a $1,200 check, many of those checks going to dead people and others not receiving them. How do we fix systemically this issue of disposable income or just access to income, you know, when you have an economic crisis like this?
So we could spend five more podcasts having the conversation trying to answer that question, but I have a few thoughts that you sparked for me. The first is, a lot of what you were talking about was about how do we make sure we build a more resilient economy and society, and who pays for that resilience? Who pays for the stockpile? I mean, there's a reason why the government stockpiles PPE. The government stockpiles fuel. If there's one thing I take away from this vis-a-vis capitalism, it's that the government is the 600-pound gorilla. No one else can print money and just simply shower it on people in the form of stimulus payments. We've all lost faith in government this last decade or two. It doesn't mean that there's no room or no role for the private sector. There's a massive role. But there's also got to be a huge role for the government here. And so I think there's going to be a lot more need for public-private partnerships. And that's always been the case in this country. We tell ourselves this story that it's really Silicon Valley and the private sector that invented all of our technology. But the fact is it was DARPA. And government has, in many ways, subsidized and or...
ARPANET is the internet.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not to take away. It's just to say that there are roles for everybody. And I think that's really, really important. It also creates very interesting opportunities to think differently about how wealth is created. Because as the taxpayers, we all help to fund the work that the government did that underpins all of these technologies that now the private sector is making tons of money off of. So we socialize the investment, but we privatize the gain. What if we thought about that a little bit differently? Maybe we'd be able to expand the opportunities for wealth building for a broader array of people in this country.
It speaks to, you know, part of what leapt to mind when you were describing that, Brett, was we have a systemic issue that is not dissimilar to what a lot of private citizens have, which is we're living out beyond our means, right? Economically, as a global economy, and especially as an American economy, we weren't putting enough into savings for a rainy day. We were looking about maximization versus an optimization. And so the second that the income in our economy quit coming in and we had to do a shutdown, you know, it's suddenly like, oh man, I was already paying interest on my credit cards and I can't afford to do it. It just snowballed so quickly for our economy because we had some of those wrong goals in how we thought about how the system was going to function, that it was going to be able to keep going forever.
I mean, I do think that the one hope I have, and I hope this is not a naive hope, I also talked to Dan about this a little bit, is, you know, there's a growing recognition over the last decade or so that Milton Friedman was woefully wrong, and that shareholders are not the only or even most important stakeholder, and that yes, customers and employees and communities are equally important as stakeholders. And so this idea of stakeholder capitalism, you hear more and more CEOs talking about it. The Business Roundtable signed a new statement about the purpose of the corporation in 2019. You know, the question will be, okay, those have all been nice statements, but can we get more than just the handful of CEOs who we know have been real leaders in this movement to step up and behave differently? Are there new rules we need to create to sort of break the investor stranglehold, if you will? Maybe we should stop producing quarterly earnings reports, as an example. I mean, when you look at
that's a good point.
When you look at the stock market, and it bears zero resemblance to the real world, zero, you know something is broken. And so I'm hopeful that there's more traction there than ever before.
Well, one thing that I think gets missed when we look at this approach to capitalism was, and I need to dig back some source, maybe put in the show notes, but a surprise to me was Milton Friedman always had this expectation that capitalism worked for the markets, but we shouldn't apply markets to everything. There was this belief that those who were making the profits were actually going to be funneling that back into other things in the social infrastructure that we had, things like healthcare and the arts and others. And what we've taken is made the market's a deity that we apply to everything. If it's the way everything should operate, as if it is a market, and that may be the place that things have run amok.
Perhaps, although if I heard you right, that philosophy suggests that the people who make the money then get to give it away. And that from a philanthropic perspective, that's how we give back. But that means that particularly in today's society, there's a handful of very, very wealthy individuals who get to decide what the priorities are for how that money should be spent. And it's up to their whims of what they think is most important. Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that they're not generous or philanthropic, or I'm not suggesting any ill intent. But I think the interesting thing about stakeholder capitalism is it's not this, let's make money and then give it to our foundation and we'll give it away. It's how do we make sure that everything's in balance all at once? And I think particularly given climate change, which, you know, is a whole nother podcast, we have to start thinking about how to make sure that everything is in balance, because, you know, wealth is out of balance. Our climate is out of balance. As you said, Jason, like our spending is out of balance. And so in a way, when you think about an integrated approach, it's really about bringing things back into balance again.
And, you know, we have some of the wealthiest people in history in the US today. And while that's great, the whole trickle-down economics Laffer curve thing, you know, it just doesn't work. And you know what? We don't have to just look at our century to look at that. If you look at feudalism over the centuries in the past, wealth just didn't flow down to the middle class. It's a pretty basic economic concept that the wealthy accumulate wealth and that doesn't lead to consumption and greater participation. But the more concerning element of this from a systemic perspective is if we don't get this right, it's just going to get worse, and I'll explain why. Is if you look at the next crisis after COVID-19, it's going to be technology-based unemployment from automation. And when you look at the problem that the market has in a highly automated society, and we can see it right now because the biggest earners in the market since the global financial crisis have been technology companies. They've accumulated more than 50% of the growth on the stock market just in those tech companies. And yet those tech companies employ dramatically lower numbers of people to the big industrials, what we would call the blue chip industrials of the 1970s and 1960s on the stock exchange. Like if you look at Ant Technology as an example, you know, per employee, Ant Technology makes about $16 million in profit, whereas JP Morgan Chase, about $500,000. And they're one of the more profitable companies. So you just don't need as many people employed. So what you have is that traditional supply and demand economics, the concept was as demand increases, to increase supply, you need labor participation. And in a technology-based world, that's not the case. And so while the economy could be going great, and the market is going great and these tech companies are trillion-dollar tech entities, they're not necessarily creating many jobs. And the jobs require high skills, high skill sets that we're not educating people for. So the potential of sort of this coming automation trend and its ability to create much greater inequality than we're even seeing today is really high. And that really concerns me, is that you're not going to, the free market has absolutely no incentive to fix that right now. It means almost that we need to reform capitalism itself, I think, Jen, you know?
Or we have to think about what's going to be the next revolution, you know, after the technological revolution. Maybe it's the biological revolution. I don't know.
Or, well, you know, we're obviously going to have to deal with climate change and the implications of that. So maybe we could, for example, create an entire industry funded by the government around undoing climate change damage. You know, if you think about that's going to be 100 years of, 100 years of employment opportunities right there, you know, fixing, undoing the damage of climate change. So, you know, how do we create the revenue that governments can afford to do that? Do they tax robots? Do they tax algorithms? You know, these are very good questions. If we leave it to the free market, we're not going to come up with a solution. We need planning. We need real planning behind this right now. And that seems to be what's missing right now. There's a lot of debate over like trickle-down economics and things like that as a result. But we don't have a unified view in terms of what outcome we want. You know, right now, if we talk about things like universal basic income or job programs or anything like that, we get accused of socialism. What is the number one aim of a society? What should be the number one goal of an economy? Should it not be to enrich the citizenry? Should it not be to provide the basic needs of the citizenry at a basic level? You should not have to worry about, in a wealthy economy like the United States, you shouldn't have to worry about having a roof over your head and having enough food in your belly, you know, with the sort of wealth that the economy produces. But we do. So you can call it socialism, but again, what is the purpose of the economy if it isn't to look after the citizens of the country it serves?
Yeah, Brett, we had a great episode with the folks at S&P Global that do measure EST, and they did show that there is a market-driven reason to care about climate change and how you approach risk and those who perform. And it goes back to, you know, to the adage of, you know, what is measured is what is ends up being managed.
Right.
And I think there's a real tie-in back to how we think about this holistic view of financial health and what you've been pursuing, Jennifer, this whole idea of we can't think of that world in silos, that I've got my physical health, I've got my financial health, I've got my job health and my family health, that there's an integrated view. And you know, you at Financial Health Network have been doing quite a bit really in pursuing, you know, for the first time, this idea of doing a fin health measurement. Can you share a little bit about that work?
Yeah, you're exactly right that we focus on the things that we get held accountable for. It's as simple as that. And that's certainly true of capitalism. And you know, as we talk about why we believe it's important for companies to care about the financial health of their stakeholders, it's not just because it's the right thing to do. It's actually because that's how you're going to have a more resilient, more successful business in the long run. We, several years ago, developed a framework, a measurement methodology for how do you know if someone's financially healthy? And we started working primarily with financial services companies to get them to start using it to measure whether it's their customers or their employees, how they're faring. And we also conduct a national survey. And so those firms are able to compare their results for their folks to national and regional averages. And in fact, we literally just published a report last week that looked at our learnings from our Financial Health Leaders Program from 2019. I think something like 8 million people through that program have had their financial health measured. At this point, not, you know, including companies who aren't part of that program, but we know are measuring, in the last 4 years, the number of companies measuring is grown sixfold. There are probably close to about 70 to 75 companies, some of them very large companies, that are engaged in this. Many of them have been doing it year on year, and they're using the resulting information either to to do product design and development, or to understand whether something they're already offering is actually working for people, or they're using it as a way to engage directly with their customer in a different way. So in other words, my customer experience and engagement strategy is focused on that person's financial health, and I'm sharing this information with them. And so we're really starting to get some maturity in this arena. And now we're starting to work with employers who want to do the same thing. We know that in the healthcare arena, particularly among insurers who are doing all of the work around continuum of care and the wraparound services, are very interested to understand this broader picture of people's financial health. So I think a lot of people immediately go to underwriting. Oh, this will give us so much more information for underwriting. And that certainly may be an important use case, but this is really about a sea change in how you understand the business you're in and how you go about measuring your success.
And I think we need some macro measures like that as well. You know, we need macro measures. Where's the tech mission for, you know, giving people tools that improve their financial health? You know, where are the tech measures that help people be just healthier generally? You know, reducing obesity, for example. You know, we don't have huge investments in technology to help you to do that. It's getting there, you know, with Peloton bikes and things like that. But, you know, there are some macro measurements we need. But listen, Jen, before we sort of wrap this up for the show today, you know, when we talk about Emerge Everywhere and the mission of this, talk to us about Dan Shulman's obviously a phenomenal guest to kick off the show, and very proud to have him on as well. But where do you go from here? You know, what's the guest lineups you're looking for? What's the content you're going to be bringing? How's that conversation going to continue as Emerge Everywhere rolls out?
I think there are a lot of silo busters out there. They may not even realize that they are, but they are. They are taking real steps to lead with empathy, to see their stakeholders in three dimensions, and to try to build businesses and strategies that meet the full continuum of their needs, whether they're delivering it directly or whether they're doing it in partnership with others. And so the show is going to bring on leaders from a variety of different sectors of the economy who have got real examples of things that they've done or things that they're thinking about that exemplify the kind of integrated financial health approach that I think we need in this country. So I hope everyone will join me.
I know, certainly I will.
I was just about to say the same thing, Brett. I loved, you know, listening to the even the uncut version with Dan. And we know that there will be a lot of exciting guests coming up. So you're going to be able to find it on provoke.fm. More media to come.
That's it for this show. Don't forget to go to provoke.fm and subscribe to Emerge. Starting in September, bi-weekly shows covering silo busters, research on financial inclusion, and the intersection of health, wealth, and education. Have a topic you want Breaking Banks or Emerge to cover? You can always email us at info@provoke.fm, or even better, Twitter @BreakingBanks1 or ProvokeCast.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.